Worth Repeating is made possible thanks to the support from the 80/20 Foundation, the Lifshutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill.
Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the first part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Irma and Emilio Nicolas Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was startled. From shocking realizations to frightening visitors, these stories all give a jolt. Can you think of a time when you were startled? Our first storyteller is Janet Matthews. Janet shares a story about a day where she knew exactly the right thing to do. Honestly, it's always the little ones you have to worry about.
I had a really bad childhood, but looking back, it made me a stronger person. My father was a cop in Dallas, a dirty cop in the KKK. My mother was a housewife that didn't do housework. They got married, had a son, bought a two-bedroom house near a school, thought they'd live there forever. 5 years after my brother, I was born, and I ruined their life. They cursed the day I was born. My mother was really upset because she had to learn to drive now. I observed my parents, and by the time I was three, I knew they weren't good people. They were hateful and mean. They hated blacks, they hated Mexicans, they hated Jews, which at three I had no idea what that was. And my mother hated pretty women because they were all bitches. After I was born, my father ignored me, which was good. But I decided that whatever they did or said, the exact opposite was the correct thing to do. And I've never been proven wrong. 9 years after I was born, a sister was born, but that was no problem because we could share a room in the house that we had to move into after I was born. But my two siblings were golden. They had to do no chores. I did chores before kindergarten. Cinderella, Cinderella. And my two siblings were not to be harmed, but I was fair game to the pack of wolves. By the time I was nine, my father quit ignoring me. He would randomly come in and start beating the crap out of me when I was reading a book. And he was over 6 feet tall, and I fought back, and I never won. But I gave him a hard time, sort of, kind of, not really. But sometimes it went out into the hall, and when he was finished, he'd throw me down, and I would slide down the floor, and my right knee would crash into a door jamb and bleed all over the floor, and then I'd get in trouble for that, too. But I also had an injured jaw that, in my 30s, had to be rebuilt from the deteriorating problem from that. And I was covered in bruises. Nobody noticed, neighbors, school teachers, but I survived it. And when I was 16, I started working downtown in accounts payable at a company, riding the city bus. And one day in the early 70s, I got on the bus, and the first six seats were taken up by white men in suits. And the way the seats were, there were three on this side of the aisle and three on this side facing the aisle, and the rest of the seats on either side of the aisle, faced the front of the bus. I was on the aisle seat of the first seat that was facing the front. And a few stops after I got on, a lady, an elderly black lady, limped onto the bus. Her ankles were swollen, and she had two heavy bags, and none of the men stood up. And I learned manners in elementary school. So I got up and said, "Ma'am, take my seat." And I was horrified by what she said. She said, "I have to go to the back of the bus." Jim Crow rules were still in effect. So what about the Civil Rights Act of 64? I said rather loudly, "You do not have to go to the back of the bus. Please take my seat, and I will stand right here beside you, and everything will be okay." She reluctantly sat down, trembling, and I noticed the whole bus got deadly silent. Everybody was watching me. I knew it. And the six white men in the suits were glaring at me with hatred in their eyes. And I glared back at them. My eyes were saying, "You want to make trouble, you have to take all 80 pounds of me." And so I was sort of busy, trying to calm down the lady, glaring at the men. They were glaring at me. The bus was deadly silent, and everybody was watching. I knew what I did was the correct thing to do, and I knew it could have gone sideways because there were a lot of people that felt like those six white men in the suits at the front of the bus, but I didn't care. I knew I did the correct thing. It was a long ride home. And then after a few minutes, I started hearing in my head the music from the movie Fistful of Dollars, you know, like the two gun guys standing on the sandy street, ready to draw, staring at each other, because the six men were glaring at me, I was glaring at them. Everybody was still dead silent in the rest of the bus. But I did the right thing. And all that I went through as a child made me realize when I see people doing the wrong thing, I do the right thing. And that hasn't changed. Thank you.
This podcast is proudly supported by the 80/20 Foundation, dedicated to creating opportunities through education, community outreach, and meaningful impact. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Our next storyteller is Gabe Molina. Gabe shares a story about how sometimes grief makes you vulnerable to negative energies. Our deepest condolences to the Molina family.
November 17th, 2023, Vidal Bear Molina died on the kitchen floor in the house where he raised a family in Georgia, Texas. My brother Joe called me. I was at work. It was a Friday. He said, "Hey, Dad's having a heart attack, and they're working on him." Dad had been sick a long time. He had a pacemaker, defibrillator. We've been throwing him his last birthday party since he was like 65, you know? So it's kind of one of those things where it's like, his pacemaker will go off, his defibrillator will hit him, and he'll come out of it. He'll be all right. He'll be sore, but he'll be okay. So I get up to leave work. I go get in the truck, and I turn the truck on, and this song comes on the radio. It was a song I'd never heard before. It was a Black Crow song called "Mercy Sweet Moan." And in the song, he says, "When I'm gone, Lord, have mercy on me." I looked at the dashboard, and it didn't say "Mercy Sweet Moan." It said 11-11, track 11, which was ominous because that was my older brother Eddie's favorite number, and he had died 4 years earlier. So a little bit of me just felt there was no need to rush home. I'll drive safe. I'll take it easy. So I end up driving down to George West. I get there and Mom's on the porch crying. My sister's sitting on the floor holding Dad's head. And the only thing I could think at the time was George West lost its town good guy and its favorite little league coach. I ended up coming back home sad, angry, depressed, heartbroken. Days went by. I was so angry. I was mad at everybody, mad at the world. I just started a new job and spent most of the day at the new job, staring at my monitor, crying, just thinking about Dad and what I'd lost. I'd go home after work. I'd sit there in a dark room and wait to go to sleep. I was mad at everything. I fought with my wife more than normal. And it was just one of those things where I was in grief. Didn't get along with anybody. At least they didn't know it. I hid it real well. I have a podcast, and I did a podcast with some hospice care folks. And they brought their chaplain with them. And so after we did the podcast, they prayed for me. They prayed for Dad. They prayed for Eddie. They leave, and my friend asked me, she says, "Hey, how did that make you feel?" And I said, "You know what, honestly, wasn't anything that they said or the talk about Jesus or the Bible or anything we're talking about." I said, "But I was just so angry. It made me mad." I said, "I don't know why." So I go home, a few days go by, and I'm laying in bed. Me and my wife are, what do we call it, bedroom divorced. So I'm sleeping in my own room, and I feel the heaviest punch on the bed next to me. It woke me up, I swung at it, and I woke up and I looked around the room and nothing was there. But I felt attacked, and I felt like there was something that was messing with me. I just couldn't see anything. So I went to bed, a couple of days go by, and I'm watching my stories. My wife says, "Hey, you need to take the trash out." I said, "I'll take it out in a minute." So I'm sitting there and I look out the front door and I see this black mass in a human shape walk up to the front door, bend over and put something down on the porch. It really scared me. I hadn't been that afraid in a long time. I didn't want to go outside, but I was so angry and so irritated with life that I said, "You know what, screw it. I'm going outside. It doesn't matter. Whatever happens, happens." Went out there, nothing happened. But I thought about it for a few days, wondering what that was and why wasn't it afraid for me to see it. I felt like I was in a point in my life where whatever that uncomfortable feeling of something evil in the room was no longer afraid that it, whether I saw it or not. So I decided to do one of the things that Dad would do. I started to pray the rosary. Initially, I bought this beautiful, large rosary, but it's too pretty to take with me. I didn't want to put it in my pocket and mess it up. So I bought a short one. I figured, hey, I'll start with a short one. So I get to work, and I've got a rough day at work one day, and it was very stressful. I decided, you know what? Let me pray the rosary. That day at work, I prayed it three times. And the next day, I realized I had three scratches on my ankle. A couple of days later, my wife tells me, "Hey, look at this scratch on my arm." So I told her, I said, "You know what? I started praying the rosary, and ever since I started doing that, we started getting scratched." I said, "So you know what? Let's just keep praying. I'm going to keep praying." You know, people always say, they get so frustrated, and they say, "Hey, my parents made me go to church when I was younger. I had no choice. I didn't want to be there." And I think I complained about that too. I was notorious for complaining about going to church. But as an adult, I'm glad that they forced me to go to church, because now that I'm circling back to my faith, I've got a place to build from. 11/17 used to be my day. It was my birthday. But now it belongs to us. I love you, Dad. Thank you.
This episode is proudly supported by the Lifshutz Foundation, a San Antonio-based charitable foundation committed to strengthening communities through philanthropy and support for meaningful causes. For this and more information, visit directory.tpr.org.
Our next storyteller is Fawn Gray. Fawn shares a story about a night out with her friends with some uninvited guests. We love ghosts that snitch. So creepy cool.
Good evening. I'm Lapan Apache, and the story I'm going to tell you today has Native American lore regarding Comanche Lookout Park in San Antonio, Texas. The year was 1999. I was 16, and my best friend and I were trying to go out. So she wasn't supposed to be seeing this boy at the time. She was probably grounded or something. So we concocted this story to tell her parents so she could come out with me. We said something like, we're going to Taco Bell, Border Town, or we had a UIL competition. So with that, I was driving a 1985 Cutlass Cruiser Blue Oldsmobile station wagon, and I went and picked up my best friend and her little sister. And then we picked up the boys we weren't supposed to see. So I always had a calling to Comanche Park. On this particular night, we drove out there and parked on the residential side and started on our little adventure, doing things teenagers like to do. And you got to remember, this park is not what you're used to seeing today. It doesn't have sidewalks and lights and directions and parking. And it was pitch black. This is very late at night. And the only path that is ahead of you is one that somebody else has taken, created for you. So the five of us are going up this hill, just very steep, and you're just hearing like crickets and spookiness and whatever you hear out there in the woods. We get to the top of the hill, and then the vibes are really weird. We're seeing like an animal carcass with decaying fur that's matted and bones, and we see another set of bones. And we're like, this is creepy. Let's get to the view, right? So we get to the view, which is absolutely beautiful. You can see downtown from there. All the city lights is absolutely gorgeous. The tops of the trees and everything is beautiful. Then we see a circle made out of stone with pentagrams and melted down candles and more bones. And we're like really freaking out. Then we start hearing this sound. Boom, 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 boom. And we're looking at each other like, is that fireworks? Is it a marching band? It's way too late for that. Boom, 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 boom. And someone said, it sounds like somebody's jumping on the roof of your car. Boom, boom. Somebody's jumping on the roof of my car. So we haul butt down the hill. We turn the corner and it stops. So there's five of us, three girls and two boys, and we're all roostered up, ready to fight, expecting to see some kids, you know, giggling and doing whatever. No one's there. The car's totally fine. So we're all getting in the car, heading home. While we're in the car, we're still kind of freaked out over what happened, unexplainable noises. The phone rings. Now, this is 1999. There's only one phone. And it lives in the glove box. So my friend pulls the phone out of the glove box, answers it. No one's there. She hangs up the phone, puts it back in the glove box. We get home very late at this time. Her mom's not there. So we're like, score, let's like keep the night going and have a sleepover. So the girls start getting their things ready to have a sleepover. And before we leave, we play the messages on the answering machine to check in. The mom left a message. The first message was for the mom, telling the girls that she was going to be working late, that she's going to be home in the morning. So we're like, yeah, we got out of it. And then the next message was us talking on the top of the hill. And it was a very specific message because it got all of us in trouble. And it was my best friend saying, I'm scared, Javier, hold me. Javier was a boy she wasn't supposed to be out with. And then you hear somebody whisper, light up the joint, fool. And we're all laughing, cracking up as we're walking up this hill. And we look at each other like, how is this possible? My friend's like, delete, delete, delete. It won't delete. She freaks out and rips the answering machine out of the wall. And we're just like, let's get out of here. Like, what was that? To this day, we can't explain how that happened because none of us had cell phones. The one cell phone was in the glove box. And there's no other way of explaining what that was other than maybe it was our ancestors trying to tell us, don't lie, don't sneak out, don't be bendejas, and to just enjoy each other's company. Thank you.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Pasha Mediterranean Grill, serving up fresh, authentic Mediterranean favorites made with quality ingredients, from flavorful gyros and kebabs to crisp salads and homemade hummus. For this and more information, visit gopasha.com.
Our next storyteller is Mac McDowell. Mac shares a story about a chance warning that saved a crew. All it ever takes is one gut feeling.
My story tonight is a bit of a ghost story, and the only reason I'm here alive is because of this ghost. But I'm ahead of myself. Let's start back in the 1950s. It wasn't too long after World War II that everybody wanted to do something more peaceful than blowing up the world. And so the international community of scientists decided to declare 1957 as the International Geophysical Year, the IGY. Now, the IGY was designed to do all kinds of things, and we got lots of things done that year. Sputnik was launched. We discovered the Van Allen belts. The air traffic control system agreed to English as being the international language for air traffic control. And Operation Deep Freeze was formed. Now, Operation Deep Freeze was the United States Navy's plan to support the scientific operations to investigate Antarctica, which had previously been investigated very little. In 1957, the Navy had the task of establishing five stations: South Pole Station, McMurdo Station, Seipel Station, Palmer Station, and Bird Station. Now, Bird Station was a set of tunnels underneath the snow. We didn't know what we were doing, so we decided to do that. It was a bad idea. It ultimately collapsed, but not while anybody was in it. But the first year, 1957, you had to have a skeleton crew over the winter. Now, understand, daylight in Antarctica lasts 6 months, and darkness lasts for 6 months, and you can get nothing done during the Antarctic night. So a skeleton crew was established to maintain the stations all across Antarctica, and there were five sailors assigned to Bird Station. One of them was a gentleman by the name of William, who everybody called Willie. And as the long, dark Antarctic night weared on his psyche, he became more and more depressed. And one evening, he said to his shipmates, "I'm going outside to clear the snow off the antennas," which was a normal chore. They had to do that almost daily. So he went outside, but he never came back. Now, there were four men left at the station, and they could not launch much of a search and rescue mission. So what did they do? They looked. They never found him. But oddly enough, strange things started happening in the station after that. For instance, the coffee maker would come on without anybody touching it. The cans in the pantry were all of a sudden well-ordered with all the labels facing out. And this continued from 1957 all the way to the point when that station was closed and replaced with Bird Surface Camp. Now let's fast forward to 1980, when I was assigned to Bird Surface Camp, along with Al and Sean and five other men. Al was my counterpart in the weather office. He had to take weather observations 24 hours a day, every hour. He was night shift, I was day shift, so to speak. It was daylight all the time. So he was there that night when the Herbie hit. What's a Herbie? Hurricane Force Blizzard. It's called Herbie because it's abbreviated on the weather forms as HUR-B. So we call it a Herbie. 50-mile-an-hour winds, 70-mile-an-hour gusts. And during all of this, the chimney on the stove that kept us warm, part of it blew off. And what happened was the wind was forcing exhaust gas back down through the stove into the main hut. Now, Al was unaware of this. He just knew he had a very serious headache, and it was time for his weather ob. The rest of us were all asleep, and we were going to be that way for quite some time had not something happened. Al walked out, passed out because of the fresh air, and fell face first into the snow. Now, Sean was in a different hut. He was tending the generator. He was reading a book when he was startled by a knocking at the hut door. Well, not so much knocking, as Sean described it, more like frantic banging. And he thought, well, this is odd. So he went to the door, because the doors weren't locked, opened it up, and all he saw was a wall of white snow moving sideways. He had a very bad feeling. So he grabbed the rope that connected all of the huts and hand over fist followed the trail until he stumbled literally across boots in the snow. That was all that was uncovered from Al. Sean immediately knew what was happening, so he uncovered Al and he carried him towards the main hut and opened the door to the main hut and instantly knew that the air was poisoned. So he thought, well, I can't leave Al here. I'm going to take him back to the generator hut. And one by one, Sean, who was a big man, and if you want to get an image of what he looked like, Chewbacca the Wookiee is probably close. And he pulled us out one by one to the generator hut. He contacted by radio McMurdo Station and asked for what he should do, and he said, give them all oxygen. Well, we had very little medical oxygen at the station, but we had lots of industrial oxygen from the acetylene torches. So once the medical oxygen was exhausted, we were breathing the industrial oxygen, but we couldn't be rescued for 36 hours because of the storm. Ultimately, we made it back to McMurdo Station. The doctors pronounced us healthy. And in the report that Sean wrote up for the Navy, a part was edited out. And that was the part about how Willie banged on the door. He was convinced it was Willie. And so am I. What about you?
That's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and give us a like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Worth Repeating returns this fall. Do you have a theme suggestion? Want to join the storyboard and help shape the stories that you hear? Maybe you just want to give us our flowers. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at worthrepeating@tpr.org. Don't miss part two of the Worth Repeating podcast on the theme Startled, now streaming. Worth Repeating is made possible by the 8020 Foundation, Lifshutz Foundation, and Pasha Mediterranean Grill. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.